And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for the week of March 15th, 2022. The global carbon dioxide levels are 418.34 parts per million, and there are 2,849 days left until the year 2030. The clock is ticking. Well, it turns out that there is a hunger strike being held by six very committed activists in order to protest something called the Peabody Peaker Plant. The Peabody Peaker Plant is a natural gas fired power plant of the North Shore of Massachusetts that should not be built for a variety of reasons. And those reasons are so egregious that these folks have decided that they are going to go on a hunger strike to try and call attention to it. But that's not the specific target of our discussion tonight. I guess what I want to explore a little bit is the question of how someone's life grows to the point where they are so concerned about climate or see the issues in such stark terms that they feel compelled to take the kind of action that says, I'm going to stop eating, right? And that's an important statement to be drawn attention to. And I think that it is that kind of discussion helps other people find their own way into caring about climate. Because I believe everyone has their own justification for why this is important work to do. So Nathan, can I throw the ball in your direction first, just to kind of, you know, when did you first become aware of this, and why did climate change and not God knows what other thing attract your attention?
So I'm a parent, and I'm a scientist and an educator. And I think what really changed things for me was my own students at Boston University putting their bodies on the line and putting their futures at stake to fight for fossil fuel divestment at BU, to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. And when I saw my own students doing that, it really woke me up. And so my first act of nonviolent civil disobedience was at the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline to try to stop that project. And what I learned from that was that there's so many disasters that are happening, and we need to stop them. And along the way, you meet the most wonderful, just beautiful people like those that I'm with right now. And these are communities of joy. I think about the writer Rebecca Solnit, who wrote the book called A Paradise Built in Hell, and how communities emerge in the aftermath of disasters. Well, the Peabody Peaker is a disaster, and we're a community of joy that has emerged taking this action together.
That's beautiful. Speaking of joy, let me ask you, how's that for a segue? Tell me, why are you here? And can what's your sort of analog story?
Well, I wasn't involved with the climate crisis at all. I was living in Massachusetts, and for some reason, I felt drawn to go to the People's Climate March in New York City in 2014. That was the one that they were expecting 50,000 people. And 400,000 people showed up. I mean, it was 2 miles long on Central Park West. And they wanted to have a moment of silence for the indigenous communities and frontline communities that were most affected. And I'm in this crowd of people pressed, you know, together, bands are playing, people are singing. And I'm thinking, they can't have a moment of silence. And all of a sudden, from downtown, it started getting quieter and quieter and quieter. And then all of a sudden, I was standing in silence. It was just a moment. And then it moved uptown and the crowd roared. And I have to tell you, in that moment, my heart broke open. Mm-hmm. I felt such love for this planet and its people and all life on Earth. I was blown away. So I found out that Bill McKibben had organized that march, and he was from 350.org. And I discovered that there was a 350 Mass organization in Massachusetts, and I joined the North Shore node of that.
What a fantastic story. What a great story. Wow. So Rob, can you top that one? That's going to be a tough act to follow, but why are you here?
I have been those moments of silence. I got chills just hearing Joy tell the story. Such a beautiful human gesture. My story starts with Rolling Stone magazine. And I read an article by Bill McKibben, who I didn't know at the time. It was about 10 years ago. And I finished reading the article and I set it down. And I said, well, this is going to mess with my life. I can't unsee this. I wish I could unsee this. Why did I read this article? And it was true. I was like, I had no idea that greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels was actually going to start wreaking havoc, possibly in my lifetime. But not only that, that it was going to threaten the things I love the most. I'm very outdoorsy. And I live for swimming, running, biking, and just being out in the wild world. And I thought, all of this, we're going to waste this. This is crazy. And the other thing was, I was like, and people knew about this. Mm-hmm. I was like, how is it possible that people have known about this apparently for decades, and I'm just finding out about it, right? Like, I'm not a scientist, so who are the people to know? Why didn't they tell the leaders, and why didn't leaders say, hey, we got a problem, let's fix it? So it was lesson one about another lesson about mankind and the very difficult to understand way that we go about our lives. So pretty much I was in despair and anxiety, and some wise person said, get active. He said, you sit at home and it's going to drive you crazy. So I did. And I've been active ever since. 5 years ago, I retired, and I do this full time. I'm fortunate. Great. Life that I'm able to do that. I'm not doing this for fun. You know, it's like I could do something else in retirement, but this needs to be done.
That's great. I think Joan Baez is smiling somewhere, right? She's the one who said antidote to despair. Action is the, I think that's an important thing to keep saying, right? When you look and say, oh my God, right, that's when you need to get off the couch and okay. Roger, tell me, why are you here? You've heard some of these stories. What brings you to the table?
You know, I think of the week every summer that I spent with my daughters and my partner in camping at Acadia National Park when my girls were growing up, and being in the woods, and, you know, the amount of energy that their mom and I spent organizing activities for them when we were home just became available for other things when we were at Acadia, because they would start to play in the woods and they needed no support or intervention or inspiration from us. They were inspired by the natural world around them. They would just make up the most wonderful games being out in the woods, you know, and just soaking in that environment. And that's a world that, you know, I don't want to see it disappear. And I'm afraid that it is, you know, in the fires in California and in British Columbia. And I'm horrified that my children and future generations wouldn't have those same beautiful places to visit. So that's I think the original source of my.
I think that's a beautiful statement. I mean, it really is that sort of primal kind of thing that sparks.
But I had a similar experience to Joy at the 2014 People's Climate March. Mm-hmm. I'd say it might have been the highest moment for me so far mm-hmm. in my life as a climate activist, yeah. because the thing what we always struggle against, I think those of us who are trying to fight the good fight, is feeling that either we're alone or we're overwhelmed or it's not, you know, we feel hopeless or that the odds are against us. And that was a moment when I felt like, wow, there's a lot of people, 400,000 people in the streets of New York who all are trying to move the world in a similar direction. That was very inspiring and hopeful to me.
Wow. 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 So Sue, did you go to New York?
I'm a reader, and about a decade ago, my partner was ill and I was spending a lot of time at home with her reading. And I stumbled over a book, which is not one of the usual books about climate change that people read. But it was a book that described sort of the interlocking networks throughout nature and how this guy was a naturalist and he would watch the migrations come through and he'd say, gee, you know, these ducks are coming 2-3 works earlier than they usually do. And when they get where they're going, what they eat when they get there won't be there because, you know, something else is out of sync here. And I just suddenly, I didn't know anything about climate change, but I suddenly had this sense of holy cats. I will say holy cats because I'm on the radio. you know, this is really the whole shebang. And there are some laws of intensive care medicine that you learn. And one is, the third one is everything is connected to everything else. And the fourth one is there is no such thing as a free lunch. And that to me totally made sense. And I'd always been a person who, you know, looked at various causes and thought, well, you know, I can see this side and I can see that side. I could only see one side to this. Though this was wild and this had to be changed. So I started, as others have, I started going to 350 Massachusetts meetings. And I went to a training. And at the end of the training, they put sheets of paper up on the wall and said, write down one thing that you commit to do for the climate. And I looked at what I'd written and I'd written, in 1 year, I'm going to be retired and doing this full time. So I did.
So Judith, all right, you please. What's your story here?
We have some good stories. So it was so good to hear that Roger took his kids camping because my father used to say the last time a Jew went into nature was to get the Ten Commandments, and it was under duress. We weren't a big outdoors family, but was always aware of all the horrors that we perpetrate on the environment. My poor son, I would never give out goodie bags when he was a kid and having parties because I said, that is just plastic crap. It ends up in the solid waste. We will give gift certificates to good nonprofits for each kid. And he'd look at me and go, Ma, I'm going to be in a therapist's office because of you. He turned out to be just fine. So then, just like everyone else, at a certain point, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, I read, this changes everything, the end of nature, the sixth extinction, and ended up on the couch needing a catheter because I thought, I'm never getting up again. And realizing that indeed, the only antidote to despair is action. And went to my first 350 meeting, and it was hysterical because Cheeto Head had not gotten into office yet. And at our third meeting, Cheeto Head had gotten into office, and suddenly we had 50 more people at our meeting. It was like, whoa, talk about activating people. And going around, and you know how it's really important, as we've all said, to learn to have conversations with people who have really different belief systems. But this felt like home. You know, it felt like people who I'd met in Clamshell Alliance and gotten arrested at the site of the Seabrook nuclear power plant with, it's almost like we said, we can work together on this. We had a similar, I said, it's a bunch of old anarchists. We're at home together. But because you can't do this work alone, you'll end up back on the couch. Yeah. So you find your peeps and you don't know what moves the dial, but you just keep pushing everything at it.
Well, this has been like really fascinating. I hope you six have appreciated each other's stories as much as I've appreciated all of them. They're just really great. I would say that I'll put up the links on the blog at massclimateaction.org, but there are no links here. Or maybe I'll put up some links to some of these books, right? Because there are good books to read that'll scare the pants off you, so to speak. But these stories, yes.
Ministry for the Future.
I'm reading that right now. That is really an uplifting. I mean, that is a good book to read. Yes. In fact, the fascinating thing about climate stuff is you can just launch off into all these other topics. But I mean, the whole question of how the protagonist goes from Zurich to San Francisco sailing and then on, it's like this, you know, how are we going to travel in 2050? But that's another podcast. You'll all have to come back on to discuss that. But yes, I highly recommend Ministry for the Future. We'll put those links up. Anyway, if you have idea, the blog is going to be at the massclimateaction.org. Go to the banner, look for newsletter and more. Pull that down. Look for blog and podcast. And right there, you'll find the SoundCloud link with all these hot links underneath it to the various books and stuff. If you have a question or comment about the show, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what the heck we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to this on your smartphone using Stitcher or one of the other modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So you guys are wonderful for being here. Thank you so much. I wish you the best of luck going, you know, and I hope that you can come back very soon to tell us about all the good things that happen as you tour the municipal light plant towns over the next few days. Bye, everybody. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Very cool.